Today, a conversation about water all around us, WBTV LP 99.3 WBTV.org. I'm happy to present and welcome to the show. A group of people will speak with three scientists from the EPSCoR program at the University of Vermont. And EPSCoR is even bigger than that. It's all over Vermont and the country. Its extensive cutting-edge research is helping us understand exactly what's going on, what's happening with water in the hills and valleys, rivers and lakes of Vermont, and how it applies across the country and really around the world. Science is like that, isn't it? It pervades. It is ubiquitous, and the reality is there. And these are researchers who are doing really pretty phenomenal research right here in our backyard. We want to look at, at this time when we're wrestling with how to address water quality. Science is what informs us, and EPSCoR is a powerful transdisciplinary program with significant funding from the National Science Foundation. You know, we have extreme weather events, and they're a major factor. Water moves 12 months a year. All of this affects our water quality and how we need to manage water as Vermont moves into the future. EPSCoR's full name is the Established Program to Stimulate Competitive Research. Now, there's a mouthful. And you can check out all the work that they're doing at their website, which is www.uvm.edu/, and this is case sensitive, EPSC, lowercase O-R, EPSCoR. So uvm.edu/EPSCoR. We're going to jump into the conversation and what really happens, find out a little bit about what really happens with water in our landscape. Happy to present this conversation to you, and we'll jump in right now. I'm very excited to have with us today some folks from the EPSCoR program at UVM, and that's about the most broad and vague description I can use for that. It's a program. But EPSCoR is a science, a major statewide science project for years now. But we're going to talk about some of the research specifically around water, but also about techniques. And I'm joined by Julia Perdriel, who is an associate professor at UVM in the geology department and also the co-director of the environmental science program in the College of Arts and Sciences. That's long, and then we can add on to that EPSCoR too.
Yeah.
So great. So Julia, you have suggested that we bring two more people into this conversation. Can you just tell me where Aaron and Dustin fit into the project?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're all part of the EPSCoR project, and I think we're going to explain a little bit more of what that actually means and what it does. But Aaron and Dustin, they're two extremely smart early career scientists that are really on the ground, and they do a lot of the science that we dream up. So they're figuring out how to capture a lot of the variability that we're seeing in the winter. They have to figure out how to sample a season where nobody wants to be out, like whether it's sleeting or whether the rivers have really high and there's ice breakup and all these things. So they're figuring out how we actually can capture it this time of the year. And it's really interesting because it's very relevant for what happens in the summer. We know that in Lake Champlain, we have these issues with the algal blooms. And one thing that we might think is, well, the algal blooms, they happen in late summer and fall. Why would we have to study the winter? But I think they will explain a little bit more in detail why you actually have to go to the winter to understand the summer and go to the mountains in order to understand the lake.
Yeah. Great. And so that's our segue to introduce Dustin Kincaid and Aaron Siebel, who are both researchers, but that's just what they actually get out and do. They're postdoctoral students, they are both postdoctoral associates, I shouldn't say students, which means you are scientists, as Julia describes, in your early years, but you're postdoctoral associates with Vermont EPSCoR, and which is a big program throughout the state, and you're part of the within the ecology team, which is within Bree, which is within EPSCoR. And I guess it would be interesting to look at just a quick sort of, how did you get here? Because I think that's an interesting journey for most scientists. You want to start, Erin?
Sure. Well, I got hooked on research as an undergraduate. I started getting out in the field with one of my professors and spending the summers doing research, and I decided that I wanted to make that my career. So I got my PhD in ecology. And as I was looking for postdoctoral positions, I saw this position advertised, and it really was a exciting opportunity to do this sort of interdisciplinary work in Lake Champlain, thinking about a really interesting scientific question that also has a lot of really important societal implications. And so I wanted to kind of continue to work in this sort of social ecological setting. And so I decided to join the EPSCoR team.
Oh, great. And Dustin, how did you end up here?
So similar to Erin, I got involved in undergraduate research in a river ecology lab. And then basically did a bunch of technician positions, ended up back in graduate school, finished my PhD at Michigan State University, where I was working in smaller systems like small ponds and wetlands and lakes and looking at mucky sediment interactions with the water column. And that was fun, but I was done mucking around, so I wanted to move to a new space in science. And so this Vermont EPSCoR postdoc seemed really ideal because this team uses many networks of sensors to let the environment speak for itself, and it's at the forefront of our field, and so I wanted to learn how to work with these data and learn what they could tell us about water quality and the controls on water quality.
And that really jumps us right into EPSCoR, but one thing that's so important is the interdisciplinary nature. You know, you all three of you have alluded to it, but that's the model that we're looking at, right, Julia? And why? Why do we do that?
Yeah, it's really, I kind of think about it almost like for music, right? When people are wondering what science is all about, a lot of people like music and listening to music. And when you're thinking about an orchestra, there's a lot of different single instruments, and the musicians are excellent and extremely skilled at their specific instrument. But in order to pull off like a magical symphony, like say Beethoven's Ninth, right, you need to have all of these instruments interacting with each other in a very smart way. And I think this is very much what we are trying to do with these interdisciplinary science programs like EPSCoR. We have a lot of scientists that are very expertised in the single discipline, but in order to make the magic work, you need to merge these disciplines. And just to give an example, for figuring out the algal blooms in Lake Champlain, what we do for EPSCoR, we need to look at water. So there's hydrologists involved. We need to see how vegetation fits in, so biology is involved, and we need to figure out where does the phosphorus actually come from. So maybe there is some rock stuff involved. So suddenly you need all of these different instruments working together. And I think that's my favorite way of doing research, because I think we can answer some of these really big questions like water quality, food security, climate change. We cannot answer these questions with just one single discipline. We have to work together. And it's, you know, when you're thinking about what is necessary to pull off a symphony, it's hard work. You know, it's a lot of practice, a lot of rehearsals, and that's what we're doing. But it also has these big rewards, and I think we're going to figure it out.
And you're gathering data across the board. And just in your project alone, am I right that there's geology, mineralogy, soil science, geochemistry, hydrology, and microbiology.
Yeah, so this is kind of the disciplines or instruments that I dabble with in my research. I started out as a mineralogist and geologist, and then I added all these additional disciplines to the mix because I just find it so fascinating. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think a lot of interesting questions are. And we talked maybe a little bit about EBSCOR already. There's also the social sciences aspect, right? There is the economy aspect, and then there's these additional approaches and tools that we can use to make sense out of it. So, yeah, the interdisciplinary is really what drives all of this.
And with water quality, I mean, part of that interdisciplinary has to do with how it impacts so many areas in society. I mean, we think about food, we think about, obviously, water itself. But, if we're going to answer questions that grasp all that, we have to look at it from this kind of a perspective.
Yes, absolutely. I can probably give an example that some people might have a relation to already for the Northeast, is that many, many decades ago, people realized that fish were dying in streams and in lakes, and that the trees were dying too. And, in order to figure out what's happening, we needed many disciplines, 10 plus disciplines, to work together very smartly to figure this out. The reason why actually the fish in some stream died was not necessarily to be solved in that stream. We had to go to understand what's happening hundreds of miles away in the Ohio Valley with emissions that lead to acid rain, and then this rain rains onto the landscape, changes the composition of the soils, changes the composition of the groundwater, changes the composition of the streams, and ultimately at some point it ends up with the fish. But it's one of these examples where all these different disciplines had to work together to figure this out so that ultimately we as scientists could inform policy, which led to the Clean Air Act. And this is one of those wonderful success stories where science, yes, it took a while, but it really, really matters now. And we have much cleaner air. Mm-hmm. And we hope to do the same with the waters.
Wow. And, it is a great example because I think people who've been around here a while, I think that the real, alarming indicator was when the trees on Campbell's Hump started dying.
Yes.
And people found that so alarming that it struck them, because you only have to walk out the door to see Campbell's Hump. And so then the Clean Air Act, I think that's a great example of how much work goes into doing something that's effective mm-hmm. when it comes to policies. And that's where science and science research and policies and government and politicians all come together. And that can be a tough juncture to mm-hmm. get to.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of interesting long-term but new, and I think it's really important to emphasize that EBSCOR also has both new techniques, new models, new approaches to this multidisciplinary. And you have, and I won't blame you, but someone has sent Aaron and Dustin out all winter. But in winter, water's all frozen. So why would we bother, Aaron or Dustin?
This is a good question. Is why do we head, if we're concerned about something that's happening in a lake, so if we use the example of acid rain, we see these trees dying in Lake Michigan, Lake Michigan. I'm clearly from the Midwest, the greatest of lakes. Lake Champlain also being a really great lake, although not officially. So what we started noticing here is that we're seeing more of these cyanobacterial blooms, these harmful algal blooms that occur throughout the summer and in the fall at various times, which are damaging to the ecosystem. They're unsightly to look at, they're smelly, and they can actually be very unhealthy for people because they produce these toxins. And so we needed to figure out sort of why these are happening, when they happen, why do they happen then, sort of what are the controls on these? And so to do that, we needed to sort of head to the mountains, to the uplands. So you can think of a lake as sort of a drainage basin. So if you took a topographic map where you could see the relief and feel the relief, the texture of the landscape on there, and you poured some water and you observed where all the water flowed, that's the catchment. And so the Lake Champlain catchment is very large. And so as water moves from, say, the high points in the mountains into the soils and into the streams, it picks up with it nutrients and other chemicals. So imagine that you wake up in the morning, you have your coffee filter, you fill it with coffee grounds, and then you pour hot, clear water through it. And what results is this brown liquid that fuels us, but it's full of these dissolved organic carbons. And so it picks up these dissolved organic carbons as it moves through the coffee grounds. And you can sort of think of that as water moving through the soils within the drainage basin and then into the streams, and then those chemicals or those solutes or those nutrients then move down through the streams and into the lake. And Aaron can tell us a little bit about why we're targeting the winter.
So one other thing, Aaron, you're talking about what you just described, Dustin, is in the soil though, too, right? I mean, you can't just watch the surface, right? It's all moving. And that's, I'm speaking as a non-scientist. Mm-hmm. It's all moving, and that goes down into it. So I just wanted to make sure I'm understanding that.
The subsurface is where all the action's happening. And so we need to understand how, you know, there's all these flow paths that water takes to end up in the lake. And you can imagine a drop of water taking this long journey through soils and into a stream and into the lake. And oftentimes, the longest part of that flow path is actually, can be in the soils. It sort of spends a lot of time potentially interacting with all of these soils that act as sources of nitrogen or phosphorus or carbon. So we definitely have to look up into the watershed, like Dustin was saying, to understand what that coffee filter is sort of filled with. Because you can imagine if we have an agricultural field, we're sort of changing the contents of that filter, right? We're adding nutrients to that landscape that then are changing the chemistry of the water that's leaching out at the other end, sort of. We think a lot about how both subsurface and surface water interactions, I guess.
So when you talk about the scale, what kind of scale are we talking about for this particular study that's going on here in Vermont? I mean, I guess I don't know how to measure it. Miles, number of sensors, something like that, though. I'm not looking for a precise number.
But. Yeah, so we have our approach in this study is really to have three different research sites where we do a lot of intensive monitoring of riparian areas, soil water, groundwater, stream water. And these are sites that are located in catchments with different land use. So we have an agricultural site, a forested site, and an urban site. And these are all in the greater Missisquoi River Basin, which is one of the major tributaries into Lake Champlain. But, you know, for kind of a scale of reference, you know, our forested site is really close to Jay Peak, and that water all ends up in the lake. And so that's, you know, an hour and a half from Burlington, but we still need to understand what's going on there to understand, you know, ultimately what's going on in the lake.
And so how are you in Canada as well, or is that a hard border for you folks?
So we don't have any.
Missisquoi River runs, kind of goes a couple different directions, right?
Yeah, so we do not have any research sites in Canada, but you know, a good example is of this sort of transboundary resource is that last week EPSCoR hosted a meeting with the International Joint Commission for Lake Champlain. So it's a, you know, it's certainly a collaborative issue that both sides, I think, of the boundary are thinking about and trying to work together on.
Sort of gets back to what you were saying, Julia. I mean, that would be another example. I mean, Lake Champlain is in Canada. Mm-hmm. It's obviously on the edge of New York. It's on the edge of Vermont. But it all has to work together. And does your research fit into a context worldwide as well, or countrywide or region-wide?
I think that we face very similar issues across the globe. Eutrophication, which essentially just means too much of the good stuff, right? It just means too many nutrients. That's an issue around coastal zones. It's not only limited to Lake Champlain. So findings of our research will also help probably, you know, inform research in other areas too. At the same time, a lot of this is highly site-specific. So it's a really interesting setting where we know part of this is applicable across the globe, and another part of this is really highly specific to Vermont, just because of what type of soils we have, what type of landscape we have, what type of people we have, right? Vermont is a great place to do this type of research because I always feel people are very much connected to their land. They're paying attention. They're seeing like, oh, wow, this, you know, they're paying attention like the lake is not frozen that often anymore, or what's going on, or you know, how does the landscape look like? So it's a great place to do it. So to answer your question, it's kind of both, right? We're answering a question specifically for Vermont, but it has much broader implications.
And is there data from other places in the country that, I mean, I guess there would have to be data that has an impact on understanding Vermont as well.
Yeah, I heard Vermont described as kind of the canary in the coal mine because it is a fairly small place, but it's also very responsive to some of these big changes that we're seeing. And we're probably seeing a response to these changes earlier than in some other systems. But you know, Dustin mentioned the Midwest and the Great Lakes, and they have these issues of algal blooms too. And it's not only the nutrient status that worries us with water quality issues, which is one of those big ticket items in research that we're trying to fix for or understand, right, for the larger population. There's other issues related to this also. One aspect of my research that ties in is how much carbon is in the water. Carbon is a good thing. We're big chunks of it are made out of carbon. Each time we eat a cereal bar, we're consuming a lot of carbon. It's a good thing. But at the same time, it always matters where it is and in which form it is. And we know that we have a lot of carbon right now in the atmosphere, so its gaseous form is a greenhouse gas, and that brings us trouble. As long as the organic forms of carbon are in a solid or in a liquid, there's no trouble with the climate. So we're trying really to study how carbon stays in the solid and the liquid form and is not messing with our climate. And this has U.S.-wide implications, and one of my research projects, we're really trying to tackle this question. How does all that organic carbon enter in our waterways? Because once it's in the water, it's very easy convinced to become a gas and impact the climate. And especially in the Northeast, when you wonder, like, what is organic carbon? Like, how do we know that it's there? And pretty much any stream or pond in the Northeast, it looks brownish, right? It has, like, this really characteristic, a little bit like a diner coffee sometimes, you know? It's, like, sometimes that brown. And that's all that organic carbon. It's not, you know, it's not good or bad. It just matters where it is and what it does. And so this is one thing that we're studying in my research for water quality.
And I always imagined doing research and scientists going out and taking all these samples. And that must have been a lot of data. But are you suggesting, I'm looking at Aaron and Dustin, that this is constant gathering of data? In other words, you've installed these. And you actually have to take some of the credit for installing some of them, right, Julia? But, yeah, this is ongoing data so that we really see change and activity.
Yeah, so Aaron mentioned that we have three watersheds that we're continuously monitoring. And then I'll also mention, though, we don't work directly on them as much as some of our other team members, but we also have continuous monitoring sites in two bays in Lake Champlain, both Missisquoi Bay and Lake St. Albans Bay. And so we have three buoys out on those bays that are collecting environmental data continuously throughout the summer. And so Aaron and I work more up in the uplands and in the watersheds. And so at our sites, we have a series of sensors that are in the streams. And those sensors are trying to tell us everything from what temperature is the water throughout the day. They can tell us what the pH of the water is. Some of the sensors can tell us about what nutrients are in there and at what levels those nutrients are in there. And then we also, as Aaron mentioned, we also work in the soils in this riparian area. So riparian, we mean the habitat that's right adjacent to a water body that's sometimes influenced by that water. So it's often those like wetter areas. And those are sometimes well connected to these surface waters like streams and lakes and wetlands that we really care about. And so we also have sensors that are in those soils that can tell us that monitor the conditions in the soils like pretty continuously every 15 minutes over time. Because what we're learning is that what we used to be able to do is we would send a team or a person out to these systems, and we might only be able to grab one sample or take one soil measurement, or maybe we just do it, you know, a couple of hours for a couple of days, and then we have to go back to our labs and analyze the samples. It's very time-consuming, and also it limits sort of the story that the environment's trying to tell us. And so the really exciting part of this Vermont EPSCoR program is that we have all these sensors out there which are collecting data continuously, real time, every 15 minutes in these different environments. And so we can take these data and sort of let the environment sort of help us tell the story. What is its story? And so it's a really exciting time period, because a lot of the processes that we care about occur a lot more rapidly than we might have been able to capture if we had just gone out and grabbed one sample. One example is that storms are really important for moving nutrients from the soils into the streams and then eventually to the lakes. And a lot can happen in a really short period of time. And so we have sensors out in the streams that can tell us exactly how much water is moving through the streams during a storm. And then we also have sensors out there that can tell us the concentration or the level of the nutrients that we really care about, let's say nitrogen and phosphorus, which eventually fuel the biology and the organisms in the streams and the lakes. We can learn exactly how much is being moved during that storm, whereas before, if you just went and took one sample during that storm, you might miss the really high concentrations that occur, and you might miss the really low concentrations that occur as that water is moving out of the soils and into the streams. And so we have a better idea of exactly how much of these nutrients are moving from the soils and into the waterways that eventually move to Lake Champlain.
And Aaron, do you want to add to that? Because I feel like add to that doing it all year.
Yeah. Right. So I will say, we're very interested in this project in thinking about not just the summer and the growing season, but also expanding our understanding into the winter months. And we're interested in that for a couple of reasons, but you know, in a place like Vermont, winter is a lot of the year, right? This past year, it was long winter. In the past, we as scientists have studied this time of the year relatively less than we have other parts of the year.
By this time, you mean winter.
Winter, yeah. Right. And so we've focused less on winter months, and this is because, you know, it's cold. It's sort of difficult to get out in the field and take a lot of these measurements. And we kind of thought, you know, there's potentially less biological activity. There were reasons that there was less focus on this time of year. But we're learning that winter is actually, it's a really sensitive time of year to potential climate changes. And it's also turning out to be much more dynamic than we thought, that there's actually a lot more going on in winter months than was previously understood. And so one thing that we're focused on as part of EPSCoR, one type of sort of, you know, extreme event that we're going to be seeing in Vermont more are these rain on snow events. So when you have a snow covered landscape, you know, it warms up for a few days and it rains on that snow, there isn't a good understanding of how water is moving through that landscape during that time. And that matters not only for, you know, stream flow, but also for what kind of nutrients it's picking up. What is the coffee filter that that water is percolating through during these wintertime rain on snow events? And so we're able to use some of these higher frequency sensor technologies to better characterize winter months. And that said, it's still a challenging thing to do in the winter, even with these improved technologies. It is a lot of time spent outside during a period of the year when most people like to stay inside. But, you know, it's also, it's exciting to do because it feels like an exciting forefront to be contributing to, I guess.
Is that, Julia, I'm wondering, and feel free to chime in, this seems like really part of where EPSCoR is the cutting edge accurate, because that's the way it feels, and what we've just talked about is an enormous amount of data, and I don't know how you manage all that data, but that would be another part of the discussion. But this is really innovative science.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those surprising things that we're thinking about that seem counterintuitive at first, you know, that you kind of think about these old Charlie Chaplin movies when they're kind of closing the trunk and then the hood pops open, kind of these that seem to be disconnected at first, but that are very related. And the research in the winters that will help us so much understand the summer, and the research in the mountains will help us so much understand the lake. And EPSCoR is truly at the forefront with this. It's one of those orchestra deals where you really need a full team to make that happen. And you mentioned data management. That's a big, big part of this project. We have specialists that know exactly where to put the data and how to share it and all of this. It's not easy. But it's very, very relevant, and I think it's where science is going right now with big strides. Yes,
it really sounds like that. I mean, it sounds like the pioneering area of science at this time.
Yeah.
And so, one thing we've gotten really good at is gathering data. That's for sure, because it's easier. Keeping track of it and interpreting it is a really different piece. And what are we to look at?
Yeah.
Right. So I guess I'm curious for any of you to kind of talk about, and Julia, maybe you should lead because this is one of your specialties, is do you look at small, isolated, and you said that how things are behaving here is a little different too.
Yeah.
And I think, Aaron, when we were talking, or maybe it was you, Dustin, earlier, talking about that there's been a lot of polar research, right? But polar research it's related. It's all related. I mean, science, that's the way science is. But one thing doesn't give it to you. So you have to have a big picture, the closer picture. And I would be curious how you all look at that. But Julia, can you lead us into that?
Sure, yeah. This is one of the aspects in research that really, really fascinates me. And it's not only in research. It's, I think, as people, just as humans, we have, each of us has sort of a preference of focusing more on the details versus looking more at the big picture. And if we just knew this about each other, then we probably would fight a little less, right? But in research, it's very relevant. But as an analogy, when you want to understand why a painting works for you, you might go very close to it and you might see that, say, the way how the brush stroke is done and the direction and the thickness and all of this. But then you may need to step way back to understand the effect that this specifically does. So if we only look at the detail, we probably lose the meaning. But if we only look at the big picture, we don't see the process that actually makes this happen. And in research, it's very much the same. We need to look at all these different aspects in order to understand how Lake Champlain Basin works and what makes these algal blooms and to see when do they happen. But then we may also need to go very specifically into this one place to understand what happens at the very small scale. And this is one aspect that I think is so interesting, because now we have the tools to do both. You mentioned we collect an awful lot of data, and that's true. And we're, as a science community, working on figuring out how to use these data most effectively and how to analyze it. And with recent advances in just the computational capacity, now we get help from computers and very smart algorithms that just help us sift through some of this complexity. There's tools that their name is Complex Systems Tools. And some of my favorite people work on that, Donna Rizzo at UVM and also Kristen Underwood and they're at EBSCOR2 and a bunch of other people that really master these tools so fantastically that they really can help us figure out these big data patterns that helps us with the big picture, and then we can go in and collect additional data, step closer to the painting to understand what is the process behind the pattern now. And it's fascinating.
So it's not an either or either. We really have to look at both, which just to click back on the Clean Air Act, that was how that was successful, was by combining and then interpreting. And I'm guessing all three of you would argue, though, that we still need human beings who can interpret things and digest them and such.
Absolutely.
I say that half kiddingly, but not entirely, because there's a lot of people who think, well, now we have computers.
Yeah.
But there's more to it than that.
I agree absolutely with you. We need people to make sense out of what a computer might spit out. When one of the programs, one of my NSF grants is looking at carbon in streams, and we're using these complex systems tools for the big patterns, and they don't tell us why these patterns are there. So that's where we as humans come in, and where we step in closer to the painting and really understand the mechanisms. And that's what's absolutely necessary. So we're not in danger of being replaced by computers. They're more helping us with the data treatment. But we come in with our process knowledge, with our years of training, knowing how to play the instruments really well, to actually make sense out of what the computers tell us.
Because so much of it is also about what are the questions, right? And I know, based on what you're talking about, I don't know. That's why I invited all of you, because I don't know. What to look at.
Yes.
Like, what makes sense, what contributes to the understanding. That's another piece of this.
Yes, yeah. And I kind of like to explain also how this can work together with what we do as people in collecting data. Sort of with an analogy, when, like in Burlington, we never have so much troubles with traffic jams, but it does happen occasionally. In other places, it can be much worse. And just imagine that every once in a while, there's at this one intersection, this really horrible traffic jams, hours delays, and you would love to know when that happens to predict it, to next time avoid it. What you could do is you could stay at that intersection for most of your time and just wait until that traffic event is happening, and then ask every single driver to tell you where they're coming from, where they're going, why they're here, and then you might come up with an answer, but it would be a lot of time. It would be a little bit like waiting for a rain event, right? Or the other way is that you could use a lot of data that's available that may or may not be related. You could use data from social media events, you could school calendars, constructions, any kind of piece of data that is available online, city meetings, and feed this into one of these really smart algorithms, and they might spit you out that it might have something to do with the fact that it's Wednesday, and say that there's a road closed at the other side of town. So this is then the pattern where then you would go in, say, investigate a little bit closer. And maybe it's only when these two pieces or three pieces interact that you'll have this bad traffic jam, and then you can avoid it, you can predict it. That's what we're trying to do with research too. So we're using these data really smartly. And what we ultimately want to do is, well, we want to understand the system, but we then also want to be able to predict things. And we also want to be able to inform policymakers, saying like, we understand the system now, this is how it works. Now it's the time to hand it over to policymakers to figure out what do we do with this.
And that's that stops me for a moment, so excuse me for being slightly at a loss for words. It's a fascinating, I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, but correct me, this is a new way of doing science. It's a new way, and so Dustin and Aaron, you may represent that new way of doing science and how we have to stick with it. If these methods work better and they're really answering questions, although they're not entirely new, they haven't been sort of widespread done. And also our ability to handle data has really changed. Does that how you feel coming into it, Aaron, that you're sort of the new wave of scientists?
Yeah, I think there's a new generation of scientists who have been and are being trained to work across disciplines to do this sort of interdisciplinary work. And, you know, like the examples that Julia was just giving about these really powerful computational techniques, you know, we're also being trained to interact with computer scientists to implement these sorts of approaches in our work. And I think that that's a really great thing about EBSCORE is that it provides a training component. You know, we are able to learn from this great group of interdisciplinary scientists so that when we go on to our next positions, we'll be able to bring about, you know, foster these same sorts of collaborations, you know, use these sorts of cutting edge tools to address other environmental problems. And so I think that a big part of EBSCORE is not only doing really great science that informs policy, but also really training the next generation of scientists to be able to use these sorts of tools effectively going forward.
And Dustin, the management of all this and the data and everything else is also really an integral part of doing science. I mean, it always has been. Mm-hmm. Scientists, I mean, that's where the internet came from, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Scientists have always managed and exchanged huge amounts of data, but we've really kind of we've taken off into the stratosphere with this now. Is that part of what intrigues you? And is that I mean, you folks are going to figure this out,
right? So yeah, that's as I mentioned before. That's one of the reasons I chose to come to this program is because we're in the era of big data, and we can learn really cool things if we can harness the power of these data. And so it's just. The cool thing about Vermont EBSCORE program is that it's like Aaron said, a capacity building program. And so training scientists to deal with these big data, this new era that we're in, how to interpret it thoughtfully. And then how do we collaborate with people that can help us use it? Computer scientists, for example. But it's also, you know, tons and tons of data are coming in, and we always have to make sure that the sensors are working correctly, that we can trust the data. So there's constant upkeep with those sensors, it's looking at those time series, so the data over time, and looking at are there like systematic ways that the data are changing that may not be due to the environment but might be an issue with the sensors. And so how do we tell when that's happening? And so we're developing all these processes that can help us determine that and make sure that we're getting good data. And then it's like things like, where do we store all these data? How do we store them in a way that makes them accessible to our collaborators? In a way that that people, you know, 50 years down the road could take these data and make sense of them. So like, what other data do we store with these data so that we make sure that people can reproduce what we're doing, but also use these data in a meaningful way. This is all the things that we're trying to learn about how to effectively collect and store data so that they're most useful for other scientists here and now.
And I think it's actually maybe interesting to mention this. So the projects that we were talking about, the EBSCoR and also other funded grants, they were all National Science Foundation grants. And the National Science Foundation is very smart about this. They tell us, we need you to figure out how to share these data. This is not something that should only benefit this one person. There are very clear rules how we should make data accessible, how we share it, because after all, it's about making things better, not only for the orchestra, but for everybody who's listening to the music. And the other part also, what I love about projects like EBSCoR, but really any NSF-funded project requires you to have a broader impact activity, which really means that society has to benefit from what you're doing. And I think it's very important. We're not just sitting in this little tower doing our thing. We're really thinking hard about how does this impact the larger part. And for EBSCoR, for example, we have all these outreach programs, like going into the high schools, creating undergraduate research opportunities. Both Dustin and Aaron end up where they are right now because they did research as undergrads. And we want to bring people into this type. We want to train people into this, doing this type of research early on, and kind of give back to the people that ultimately fund projects like this.
And that's the real staying power. Is this has to work and has to be sustainable. You have to stay with it. And that starts to give us, we think, some people think of science as facts. And they are. They're the facts we have to date.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a really fascinating, you're talking, all of you, about the protocols and the sort of universal understandings, which is also part of what you're trying to establish with research like this. How do we do it?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any things that have surprised you along the way? I don't know how long each of you has been at it, but I'm guessing there's a range here. But are there things that surprise you about the data? I mean, I think about the context. I guess that's part of what I'm getting at. That was a roundabout way of getting at it. But the context is extreme weather events. The context here is a New England landscape, right? The context here is winter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think those are key pieces. And are there things that are surprising to you or things that you didn't suspect?
Yeah, so I think one example of this, we were speaking earlier about these rain on snow events, and so we started really intensively monitoring these different events in 2018. We went out starting in January and really braved some unfortunate weather to collect a lot of really good samples. And when we look at, you know, okay, all of 2018, all of the from our agricultural watershed, if we look at all the nitrate that is exported downstream, like eventually that will end up in the lake, right? So we have idea of annual nitrate export. And we actually are finding that these rain on snow events, these handful of rain events that happen in winter months, actually exported 20% of that year's nitrate load. So that's a really big number that I don't think we expected. And it's about equal with, you know, the bulk snowmelt, which is, you know, this really dominant, important time of year. But we're seeing that the magnitude of the changes associated with these rain and snow events is about equal. And so that was really, I think, surprising for us. And it, you know, fueled us or inspired us to really do this again this year. So we collected another year of data to see how that compares. And we will continue to do this monitoring. But I think that that's a good example of, you know, a sort of magnitude of change we hadn't expected certainly.
And because of the nature of capturing the data. And,
yeah,
you
know, yeah.
And the nature of just the how and also what you're looking at, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just like Dustin was saying, sort of letting the data speak for itself. We were able to capture these events and they tell this really interesting story that we hadn't seen before.
And is that the interest of the National Science Foundation, is to promote this? I mean, I know I have to always look it up to remember what EPSCoR actually stands for. Established program to stimulate competitive research. Mm-hmm. And that's a very long-term goal.
Yeah.
And so National Science Foundation is supportive of that as well as creating these frameworks, mm-hmm. right? Because everybody can't create their own framework in science.
Yeah. Yeah, the National Science Foundation really funds fundamental research and then has these various programs. What is quite interesting, one of the big themes that they're interested right now is harnessing the big data revolution. So that's what we've just been talking about. We are now able to collect big data, but are we able to do something with this? Are we able to harness the power of it? And I think we are, and we're at the time where we're having these really good ways of doing this. But yeah, I think this is very much in line of what the National Science Foundation wants, and also where science is going, really to the benefit not only for science, but bringing it back to society and what we want. We all need clean water, we all need food, and we all need a climate in which we're still adapted to, and that's really what we're working on.
And when we talk about one thing, I think it was based partly on what you were saying, Dustin, the idea of a sort of time and scale, being able to actually handle that. I mean, there were only so many, you know, 100 years ago, scientists, there were only so many samples a scientist could get out and take, right? And they were probably not using computers either. But that's a big breakthrough. And how do we harness that power is a piece of this.
Right. And I think the other important thing to comment about is, you know, this is a multidisciplinary project. And so, you know, we all tend towards the ecology side of things. And so we can go out and measure the water quality or things that tell us about the quality of the water. And we can know this. And then we can scream at the top of our lungs that we know this and it needs to change. But it's not going to change unless we understand the larger societal context and what's causing this and what sort of changes we can make with society and policy to do this. And then also being able to predict how different behaviors or policy might affect things like water quality. And so what's really exciting with Vermont EPSCoR is we have all these different teams, the ecology team, a climate team, a social systems team, and they all come together to inform this integrative assessment model, which is basically, Let's just look at it as like this smart machine in which we can tinker with how things work. And so we tell it how we think things work in the landscape, and we incorporate everything from like policies to human behaviors to how natural systems work. And then we can sort of twist knobs and say, what if the climate warms more? Or what if we get more of these extreme rain on snow events in the winter, or really long periods of drought in the summer followed by really intense rainstorms? Or let's say if we put more buffers along farmers' fields next to the streams in certain places, how might that affect water quality and how many and the length of period we might see a bloom in Lake Champlain? And so all of these teams come together to inform this really interesting, complicated machine that can tell us a lot about a complex system.
Well, I want to thank you all for taking a little time to sit down and talk about this. A fascinating research and with such huge implications for us, not just in Vermont, but certainly, definitely in Vermont. So thank you very much, and I'm going to direct folks to the website if they want to. It's actually a very entertaining website, mm-hmm. EPSCoR has. Dustin Kincaid and Aaron Siebold, who are both research associates, postdoctoral associates, and researchers with Vermont EPSCoR, and Julia Perdriel, Is that better?
Yeah.
Who is with both UVM and EBSCOR. And thank you all for sitting down to talk to us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Right in our backyard. Scientists doing amazing research and a great discussion. I hope you enjoyed it. A discussion of water and what's going on and what should inform us. Check out the EBSCOR website. It is an extensive website at www.uvm.edu/E, capital P, capital S, capital C, lowercase o, capital R. So uvm.edu/EBSCOR. It is case sensitive. And this conversation, these folks made some time, and they are out in the field really all the time, along with dozens and dozens of other scientists, including research fellows and all kinds of people. And it's just if we're going to solve these problems, we need real data. And that's what their work is about. It is a tough one. It is impacting us more than we may realize right now. And exciting to hear what they're doing. More information about water in Vermont and the research of EBSCOR also is the focus of the Vermont PBS project, Saving Our Waters. And you may want to check that out. It's a great multi-part video series. And that's over at vermontpbs.org/water. Produced that a couple years ago. It's a New England Emmy-winning program. So there's lots of good information. uvm.edu/EBSCOR and also over at vermontpbs.org/water if you're interested. And why wouldn't we all be interested? It's a huge issue, and it's a complicated issue. And I think we're all hoping that we can get on top of it. It's been in the legislature the past 3 years, and it is a tough one, and it's not going to be cheap. And but this is the kind of stuff, and especially their multidisciplinary approach, really informs real information for us to work with. And I know our legislators are attentive to it. But it's a challenge. It is definitely a challenge.